What if Jesus destroyed the Romans instead? In honor of the end of the Game of Thrones season, what's your favorite pop culture scene of undead destruction?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Don't Stop Me Now sequence in Shaun of the Dead because it introduced me to that song, which is great to run to, and it's great choreography plus zombies.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to go with a recent movie from last year, the Yeon Sang-ho film Train to Busan, which is just zombies and trains and destruction. It's on Netflix. Watch it.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going to take the end of the Thriller extended video where zombie Michael Jackson is after Michael Jackson's date because I used to reenact it as a child by kicking in the door of my playhouse like Michael Jackson kicks that door to pieces.
Creepy.
Wait, what was the question again?
Your favorite pop culture scene of undead destruction.
Undead destruction? Oh, boy. There are so many to choose from. But I think the scene in 28 Days Later when the zombies break into the apartment building where Brendan Gleeson is shacked up. It's pretty
Gentlemen, good. You can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 179. It's Tuesday, August 29th, and on this day in 1964, a weird day, Mary Poppins was released.
Why is that weird?
It's like usually Labor Day weekend, they just don't bother releasing anything, but I guess back in 1964, things were different.
They needed...
Gotta have something to do with the kids and the day off.
But that's not the strategy anymore for some reason. Why?
Because the kids are going back to school.
Right? Things were better back in 1964, somehow, probably.
For sure.
Why aren't they
releasing
the
if you're
Mary
white enough,
Poppins
that's
returns.
Good time to go back to.
Right now? Right now. Yeah, right now. It's a surprise release. They're going the Beyonce route with a major Disney
a very
release.
Expensive Disney movie.
Why not?
They're going to ham for ham the entire run
Here's
of Mary
the truth.
Poppins returns.
Mary Poppins is fine, but Bedknobs and Broomsticks is much better. There's a hot take.
That's a predictable Patches hot take from the Angela Lansbury.
Gotta go with Angie.
Yeah. We don't have any reviews this week, which I guess is why we're vamping. I'm chalking it up to the end of summer doldrums. No one's going to the movies, so maybe you're not thinking about us, but you should be. Now that Game of Thrones is over, Storm of Spoilers won't be stealing all the attention anymore. Although I guess you guys keep going in the off season, so just make room for both of us in your hearts and leave us a review. We really appreciate it. And David will decide if you were useful or not as a person.
In defense of my Storm of Spoilers listeners, there are a couple of them that have expressed interest in jumping over. So if you're new, please leave a review.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're happy.
There are 2 years with no spoilers to Storm or Storms to Spoiler. So join us.
We have a slightly different spoiler policy. We will have spoiler warnings, and then David will shout over them all the spoilers. So be careful here.
If you love
That's
spoilers,
how we do
this
it.
Is a good place to be.
We're in a constant storm, to put
That's
it in Storm of Spoilers language.
That's how America does it.
This ain't your daddy's spoiler podcast.
That was a rare Iron Man reference for me. So enjoy
Oh, wow. I didn't
us.
Even know what that was.
Spoiler, Jake forgot it because it was Chinatown.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap, the job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down.
All right, this week, for lack of new releases that we really care about, or...
For the second week in a row.
Yeah, it's... I mean, there have been a lot of reports, actually, about how this month has been just miserable for the box office and the movie releases. Everyone's just given up. I think Game of Thrones actually has a lot to do with it. There's really no competing. I don't know. Maybe that's just us being in a vortex of covering the show, too, but feels like everyone's just either watching Game of Thrones or going to the beach or working, and there's nothing else to talk about except we're going to talk about a little movie called Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a Steven Spielberg film. Why are we talking about it? It's actually being put back in theaters with a 4K remastered re-release on September 1st. And I don't know why. I guess it's the 30th anniversary or something. It came out. I'm gonna guess
Who
it came
needs
out.
A reason?
I'm guessing. It came out November 16th, 1977. You know, there was a whole like Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, pay share thing where Spielberg made huge money off Star Wars that year, and then Lucas actually made quite a bit of money when Close Encounters became a huge hit.
The story later. I read is that they made a bet, basically, that one would outgross the other.
Yeah,
so
they had percentage
like, each of them got 2.5% of each other's movies.
Wow. That's, and both of them were huge. So, wow, they're really famous and rich. That's really what we're here to talk about.
Imagine that.
We're just going to be envious.
Imagine having 2.5% of Star Wars.
But let's get serious for a second. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's one of my favorite films of all time, and revisiting it again, I was reminded why. It's basically the Spielberg face, the movie. It's all about looking at wondrous things and looking up at the sky and wondering what's out there and people becoming obsessed with their close encounter, these UFOs that are starting to touch down. And it whisks us all around the world. This is clearly a fascination for Spielberg, who wrote the movie. It's one of the only movies he ever wrote. And it's a culmination of a lot of his fascinations, not just with ufology and the paranormal, but with family and what draws us, our obsessions. And I think that's what I would really want to talk about, having revisited. Katie, I know you rewatched it. Dave got about halfway through at some point. But I think this movie sticks in our memories, and we could probably discuss it at length, no matter if we watch it again or not. But I obviously the special effects are lauded, the Spielberg's, you know, the grandiose imagery that he puts, you know, there's a ship in the desert, there's lost planes in the middle of who knows where, and there's all these
the ending is what you remember, and
sure,
it's for a reason, because it's incredible. The ending of this movie is incredible.
I remember this movie to stay on brand for its Francois Truffaut performance.
He's in the ending, so
amazing.
It all ends up.
He is in the ending.
He really nails those. Do, 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 do.
Yeah, he plays the piano.
Yes, he plays the scientist. And that's a really great detail. That was actually the selling point that originally got me to go back and watch Closing Encounters of the Third Kind.
You're mad.
More than the fact that Spielberg directed it. So there you go.
Well, I mean,
Patrick, I'm curious about what grabbed you in so much with the family stuff, because as people know, you are about to have a child. And
is
that public? Am I allowed to say that?
That?
Oh, well, we can cut that out. I was just halfway through saying that I realized. Can we say
people
that?
You could definitely know that. Yes, that's fine.
All right.
I'm having a kid.
Well, so did that influence your perspective on this movie? Also, congratulations.
Well, thank you. And I don't know if it did. Maybe deep down it did, because you start worrying about becoming a dad and you see
abandoning your children to go hang out with aliens.
I mean, I probably still would. I don't know. That's the
question.
Oh,
no.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Well, this is what I want to ask you guys. You know, the Spielberg narrative is all about, you know, broken families and fathers who aren't there. But I kind of think he sides with Richard Dreyfuss's Roy in this movie. Well, I want to get your opinions on how he portrays Roy as this guy who becomes obsessed, who doesn't understand why he's drawn to Devil's, what is it, Devil's Peak, Devil's Tower in Wyoming. And I think Spielberg has compassion for him as he's kind of like drawn away from his family. He's going nuts. You know, he's ripping up his yard. He's making towers out of mashed potatoes. The guy is a lunatic, but he has a purpose. He knows why, or he doesn't know why, but he's drawn and he is compelled. And I wonder if you think Spielberg is hard on Terry Garr's wife character, Ronnie, in the movie, and the kids. If Spielberg feels sympathy for Dreyfuss, if he's actually a hero in this movie or not. What do you think of that? Because obviously he's ruining his life and he's destroying things around him. But this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. He wants to get on a spaceship.
I think one of the good arguments to revisit Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if you haven't seen it in a while, is that because it was such a part of my childhood, a lot of my memories of the actual movie are from the perspective of the child, so it's not a very complex movie if you have a child's understanding of UFOs in adulthood. It's like, yeah, you gotta find the UFOs. You're gonna do anything to find the UFOs. UFOs are cool. Why wouldn't you find the UFOs? But the nuance that you're talking about actually does kind of, it makes him feel like an anti-hero, because with more of an awareness of how the world works, I was surprised at how often I was like, is this really the most important thing right now? To, like, rip up your yard? Like, can't you find more productive methods of manifesting your vision? And so that, I think the craziness really kind of is something I had to grow into, at least as a child who was, like, seeing this and Aliens and Indiana Jones and Jaws, like, all at the same time with, like, a heightened idea of what the universe could be. This is definitely one that benefits from also understanding the real world, even though there's a whole bunch of fantastic aliens in it.
Yeah, I mean, Spielberg has famously said that if he made the movie again, he wouldn't have Richard Dreyfuss get on the spaceship at the end, because, you know, as we've seen in most of his films since then, he kind of makes movies about the value of family and keeping these together, even as early after this is E.T. But I think he could get away with it if he just, like, because I think the way that you see him as kind of a tortured man, he's tearing up his yard and you realize he's ruining his life, but you understand what drives him and you're rooting for him to follow that thing because you want to see the cool spaceship at the end. But it also, I think it is too hard on Terry Garr, but I think it has her react in a really realistic way. Like, I don't think it goes too hard to overplay her as the nagging wife who, like, doubts him. Like, there's a part early on where, like, they go driving in the middle of the night to the road where he saw the alien the first time, and she's like, I think I'm handling this pretty well, don't you? And you kind of feel for her in that moment. Well,
they also it's get just, to make out. It's their, like, make out spot from ages ago or something.
Wait, Katie, can I ask you a question about the ending and about the cool spaceship that you're so excited to see?
I mean, I saw it. I watched the movie, but yes.
I know you did. No, I mean, you and the royal you, everybody is very excited to see the cool spaceship. And I think along with that, everybody is excited to see the creatures that are piloting it. But do you and do Dave and Patches also feel like it was a mistake to show the aliens themselves?
No.
I mean,
I don't think so, because at that point, it's gone full spectacle. It's all about... It's actually this, you know, you kind of strayed away from what we were talking about, but I'll give you this. It pays off. What?
Thank you.
You
for
did
that.
No you problem. Did interrupt me talking about the female character to talk about aliens. So
yeah.
Nice. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're,
I think yes.
An MRA. But the thing here is that the payoff is actually it kind of it gives Richard Dreyfuss's Roy the ability to leave. It says it really is wondrous, and he's followed his heart here. He's followed this instinct. He is driven to this, and it really pays off.
And he's chosen. Like, he's in this whole lineup of people who've been selected to go, and, like, they go down the whole line, and they choose him. Like, there's a reason he's there.
Well, to bring things back to the female character, he's chosen to leave her.
Well, this
forever.
Is what's so complicated. So, obviously, Spielberg is, like, 31 years old making this movie. Is Roy the tortured artist? Is Roy the guy who needs to do what he does no matter what position he's put himself in through the choice of life?
I mean, like, it reminds me of the last line from the De Palma documentary. De Palma, of course, is very good friends with Spielberg and palled around in that same scene where he says, you know, you're not my wife. My movie is my wife. And in this character's case, it's science and the discovery of the unknown.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a perfectly valid reading, but you know, what a character does at the end of the movie, even if they're the hero, doesn't necessarily have to be what you would do or the right thing. It's a choice that the character makes. It's an interesting one. I've just always felt like it would be even more compelling and sort of spark even more imagination about the unknown had the bridge just come down and the ramp come down and he had just walked up it without being led by the slimy
tentacle. Maybe, but I find it very heartwarming that they are kind of like us, that they're not
babies, basically, like escorting him as apparently like actual school children in alien suits walking around with Richard Dreyfuss.
And I like that they're really all cute. Different. Like, there's super tall, skinny aliens. There's the gray alien, the classic UFO image. And then there's those little kids with super, they don't blink. They just have the craziest big eyes. I don't know. It really, I mean, this is what I love about the movie. My heart's racing. Every time the bridge comes down, the sounds are made, we're making contact, it really feels like something once in a lifetime every time I see it. And the aliens included. But let me ask you this. What? So there's this whole motif about Pinocchio in the movie, right? They go to see they take the kids to see Pinocchio, or they plan to. I don't know if it actually happens. Pinocchio comes up several other times, and of course, John Williams actually uses the Disney Pinocchio score as part of the Close Encounters theme.
Well, he uses
the
song "When You Wish Upon a Star," yeah, which is like a motif in Disney that they used over and over again after that.
Is that true?
Yeah, like the na-na-na-na-na-na. That was like
Disney, right.
Like opening titles on VHSs
right.
when we were kids.
Yeah, like Wonderful World of Disney, the lick. But what do you think Pinocchio has to do with this movie? Is Roy becoming a real boy, or what does that have to do with the movie?
No, it's the exact same obsession, where it's that Pinocchio doesn't have a concept of what being a real boy is, but it's what he wants and it's what he's going to absolutely do, even if it takes him through some really stupid shit to get there. That's that's the same obsession. Like, you know, as much as the filmmaking is an obsession, where you get a glimpse of the faintest understanding of something that you want, and then you're just gonna obsess about it and do it and leave your family.
Yeah, I guess Roy gets the taste of what being a real boy is, and being a real boy in this case is actually whatever the aliens have, this kind of higher learning and this idea of space, and they've planted the ideas in his head. In fact, man in this movie is a puppet, and you can be free if you get off planet Earth.
To go really granular about the filmmaking, like the way that the ideas are implanted in their heads in such a like an invisible way. You know, you watch this movie with its relative lack of special effects. I mean, obviously the spaceship is pretty impressive and the aliens at the end, but it's just a lot of like things happening, like mailboxes rattling and a house full of poltergeists going, that is not especially complicated, but it's so powerful for what they're not showing you. And but I couldn't stop thinking about how
you
this
know,
movie
it reminds-
would be so differently now.
It reminds me a little bit of the special effects in Twin Peaks, The Return, which are so lo-fi, but so effective and unnerving because of that, because overwhelming the senses with spectacle, it turns out, is not necessarily the best way to impress awe on us or inspire a certain feeling. And I think, Katie, what you're saying is exactly right on. I mean, it's something that Spielberg has always done so well, in using the details of a scene to inspire and spark a certain emotion or to represent a greater whole. And everything from the tiniest details here to the iconic shot of the door swinging open in the little boy's house is it tells a much bigger story. It hints at something bigger and allows our imagination to do the rest of the work. And that's ultimately what's
well, that's. You know, there's so much detail in this movie that the DP, Vilmos Zsigmond, I believe that's how you pronounce his name.
Vilmos.
He captures, like, the matte paintings are beautiful, you know. Obviously, they shot the landing strip where the ship comes down at a different place and kind of matted that over. Devil's Tower, that just all blends together. And in this version that I was watching on iTunes, super high def, I can't even imagine it in 4K on the big screen, but, like, the way that they paint the sky in, and there's always details moving. If you watch the stars, I don't think I had ever caught this, but like little dots moving around. There's ships outside of the planetary system that we can see if we're looking close enough. And then you have really tiny details that have nothing to do with the spectacle. There was a scene that I really never noticed where Jillian, the mother character, first hears her little kid. She hears all the toys. The toys kind of come into her room and bump her awake. And she gets up and she leaves her room, and you actually see like cardboard boxes. They've just moved there, and her relationship has just crumbled, and she's on her own. I think that's really interesting. I never caught that, and because all these boxes are hidden in the shadows, but the way, you know, it's the perfect cinematography. It's a perfect latitude of light to capture that kind of stuff. And every frame is like that in this movie. That's Spielberg going all out.
My favorite thing like that, that people have probably noticed, but when Richard Dreyfuss kind of sneaks down onto the airfield where the aliens are coming, and you see a guy in the white suit kind of running after him, and you think he's caught, and the guy runs right past him and hides in the bathroom. It's just funny, and like one of those like really human Spielberg things that add texture to a scene that you don't even really think about, but the more of his work that you see, the more that it just becomes a clear pattern. I love that little
He's a real goofball in this movie, even, yeah. You know, when all the rattling mailboxes and stuff, that's so cartoonish. Or like the scene where the spaceship pulls up behind him and then you see it lift up. That's really funny, but and no, there's no place because he's about to have the scariest experience of his life. It's the perfect matching of tone. Ah, this movie.
Just wait till you see Colin Trevorrow try it in the Star Wars universe in 2 years.
When he shoots it in space, you mean?
Yeah, in actual space.
Yeah, when he shoots it in space. I'll say this. I want to say one Chris of this movie. I got to put my 2017 hat on for a second.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Oh, God. If you put your 2017 hat on, you get in trouble.
Is your 2017 hat red? Does it say Make America Great Again on
it?
No, it says
Make Close Encounters Fantastic
it's a,
Again.
It's the other hat. It's the opposite hat. Look, Spielberg is... This is a very, very personal film for him, and he has tunnel vision, and this movie, watching it again, made me think of all of his films and how... You know, he has a very, like, white experience. And even when he's making films about, you know, the Color Purple or Amistad, like, I feel like he has a very white experience of all of these things. There is no diversity in this movie. It's all white people all the time. There's a black garbage man who Roy dumps garbage on at one point where he's going crazy. And I'm just in 2017 mode these days.
There's at least one black guy in the air traffic control scene in the very beginning. I remember noticing that.
That's fair.
Wait, Patches, is this a movie about immigration, ultimately, do you think?
Well, he'll become the immigrant when he goes to their home planet. I think there's room for a sequel here, don't you? Like, now. Come
like
back.
40
boy.
Years later.
I think the aliens in War of the Worlds are the same aliens. They just got really tired of us.
What you do is you performance capture Michael Cera doing his best young Richard Dreyfuss and make it you Grand Moff Tarkin his face right on there.
Is that who you see as a young Richard Dreyfuss? Do you see Michael Cera if you're recasting?
I mean, I just feel like height-wise that's all you have to look for.
Well, that's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We had a little mini discussion about it. We got the whole movie in 10 minutes.
It all came back to Michael Cera somehow.
Yep. As all things do.
Close Encounters, it's in theaters again. Check your local listings. Is that right? Buy it on Laserdisc and watch it the right way.
There you go.
Also, it's its 40th anniversary. I'm a schmuck.
A tweet from a guy who goes by Paul Martin 1978 who asked us to talk about this open letter published by Ed Skrine, who is going to play a role in the new Hellboy reboot. He's going to be playing Major Ben Daimyo, and I am going to run out of things that I know about this, so I should probably stop talking. But he figured out that the character was written as Asian in the comics. People got upset about it, and he did the thing that, as far as I know, no one else in this position has done before, and quit. For the most part, when something like this gets whitewashed, you then get the uproar when they get cast and it quiets down, then the movie comes out and they kind of go on an apology tour like Scarlett Johansson and Ghost in the Shell. As far as I can see, all of Twitter is congratulating Ed Skrine for being the appropriate woke of appropriately woke for 2017. Dave, I'm sure you know more about the situation than I do. This seems like a good idea, right?
Wait, just before Dave gets to saying all of the appropriate good things about Ed Skrine and his decision to do this, can we talk about how insane it is that ostensibly he agreed to do this movie without knowing anything about the character, without like performing a perfunctory Google search?
Why would you do that, though? You just read the script.
You can decide for yourself how much he either didn't know or didn't realize that people would care and then heard the backlash and decided not to do it.
I don't want to take anything away from the positivity of his action. That's not why I'm bringing this up. I just, as someone who like will learn every single detail about somebody's life before I even interview them for 15 minutes, it is insane to me that somebody would take a role based on a pre-existing character and not have read like literally every book that they've
read. I don't think that's crazy.
Anyway... From now on,
I mean, I don't want to speak out of place here, but there are very specific schools of acting where the point is not to know anything beyond who you are as an actor.
That is a totally, I should say, despite the tone of my voice, this is not a rhetorical question. It actually wasn't a question at all, so my bad. Should have been framed as a question. Perhaps that's the answer. I don't know. That was just after I got over you know, the how admirable I thought.
Well, let's see how long it takes for people to figure out that Ed Skrein is in a remake of or a adaptation of Alita: Battle Angel.
Well,
the manga.
It could be a milkshake duck where it's like, you know, 2 days from now we learn that he's a secret Nazi. I don't know. But Dave,
well,
he was
Dario number one, who gave up the position in Game of Thrones to take over the Transporter franchise, which everybody thought was the stupidest thing ever. But then we got Dario number two and he was fine too. Whatever. But most importantly, this is like basically the step that needed to happen, especially for the way that Asians have been treated in American cinema. They took a loss with Ghost in the Shell, took a loss with Doctor Strange, they took a loss with Iron Fist. They just keep disappearing from American like blockbuster cinema. And the most recent example of this is not going to be Hellboy, but it turns out it's the Netflix adaptation of the manga anime Death Note by Adam Wingard that came out this week. And when it was announced that it was going to take place not in Japan, as both all the source material does, but instead in Seattle, people brought up the same conversation, and I will add that to the recent blows that Asian Americans have seen in blockbuster cinema. The weirdest thing, I think, about Death Note, and something that makes it, I guess, slightly different than the Hellboy situation, is that Death Note and Ghost in the Shell and the one that Patches mentioned earlier, anything that's based off of like an anime or a manga is also doing a cultural translation. And thus far, when that's happened, it hasn't actually ended up being profitable. So it's odd that they keep trying to do it, because you end up things with like the, I don't know, the Dragon Ball movie or this Death Note movie, which tries to take a well-written epic with mysterious characters and smash it into a movie-length thing about a teenager who like falls in love with a sociopath, I guess would be the way I would describe it after seeing it, because that's not what the manga or the anime is about. They get much more detailed.
And that's okay to make it into something else, because I think the biggest problem with Death Note in this incarnation of it to begin with was that this story needs, in order to be told in the way they want to tell it, needs considerably more time. You are Netflix. You have the resources to make it a series to have 13 episode seasons that are too long on top of one another. Why this, of all properties, was turned into a 90-minute movie is beyond me. But I think what Dave was saying about how the cultural translation, they ported Death Note over to the United States, and they do absolutely nothing to make this story, which was unique to the Japanese setting, which was originally told, unique to its American one. And so, by virtue of that, when you have exclusively white heroes, and they're fighting a black antagonist played by Lakeith Stanfield, what it says to audiences, I think, is we, the only purpose of making this movie, of translating it to this audience, was to make it more palatable to white people. And white people here are synonymous with America, and it sends all the wrong messages. And like I said in my review of the film, one, I think the whitewashing element of it, although that is a bit of a broad term for all these things, is never just an aesthetic thing. It's always indicative of a greater problem with the story. And in this case, that problem is that they're not setting this movie in the real America. I mean, they're just trying to take the story, stripping of its bones, adding some cheap 80s shtick and kitsch to it, as Adam Wingard likes to do, and calling it Death Note. And I think people are right to be frustrated.
I think it's very competently shot, but that's about all I could give to this particular adaptation. Because so much of what made the original source material compelling, which I haven't seen or read all of, just like bits and pieces of it, because it's super sprawling, but here it's condensed into montages. And because of that, any opportunity for nuance becomes an opportunity for vamping. Willem Dafoe's like Death God doesn't have any cultural basis outside of you see a picture of him in a book holding an apple, and then he has apples in all of his scenes.
Actually, like, the CG is so bad. They're so timid about representing this CG Shinigami on screen.
Thank you for pronouncing just, that. I was walking around doing it.
That they, which again, uniquely Japanese element, that they just keep him out of focus in the background of all shots throughout the entire film. Which I suppose, if this were in a vacuum, could have been an effective choice. But what little you get to see of him, you're like, no, keep him out of sight. It's terrible. And the CG version of the Shinigami in the Japanese live-action films is just as bad, and they learn none of the lessons from those movies, other than keep him out of sight.
Yeah, but it's almost supposed to be bad, right? It looks exactly like the illustrations in the Japanese movies.
But that doesn't mean it's supposed to be bad. I mean, it just means that what works on
the page doesn't necessarily work on the screen. So I guess, what's your metric of bad?
Not realistic, but it shouldn't look stupid. It shouldn't look so bad that the filmmaker is clearly embarrassed of it, which he is. So that's the problem. Well, that's a problem with that character, for sure.
Anyway, we're going to see, probably in the coming weeks, if Death Note gets a sequel, because Netflix sometimes doesn't like not and letting things die, whether or not they should. There's definitely more here.
I think a lot of people are watching the movie. I have to say, based on covering it a little on Thrillist, people are watching it. That's our only way of telling, right? Like, if people read stories about it, we don't get numbers about Netflix, but I can tell that people are watching this movie because they're searching for stories. So I bet you this gets a sequel. Not with Wingard, but...
People are interested in the property.
Yeah, totally.
I really find it hard to believe that there would be a Death Note 2. I think that maybe if there is that interest in the property that Netflix course corrects and commissions a series... based on Death Note, and that gives them an opportunity to fix some of their
definitely ramping up their anime programming. I don't know if you've read about this, but they have so many original Netflix anime series coming to all worldwide platforms, actually. And yeah, I'm not surprised that this was their first like blockbustery franchise attempt, because the anime contingent is huge. It was before Netflix, and it's only growing after Netflix. The library is large.
Well, we haven't solved Asian whitewashing in Hollywood yet, but positive steps are being taken while Death Note is the flaming poop on your doorstep right now on Netflix.
All right, to wrap up today's episode and to wrap up the summer, because man, the summer is over. Let's get it done. This is I feel like a month ago we had a conversation about how great the summer was, and now August has set in and summer is terrible again. It's really bad.
Yeah, was it Dunkirk? Like Dunkirk happened and then everything just really went down from there.
But as we often do to wrap up our summers, I have prepared a little bit of trivia for you guys to play.
Matches.
Who
matches,
is matches. Ready to play? I have a bunch.
Born ready.
I feel like this is going to way too long, so let me just speed through it.
Yes.
Here's how we're going to decide.
Are you keeping score?
Yes, I'm keeping score. I have three paths for each one of you to take, and we'll decide at random. Well, we're
it's
not
like
deciding at random.
Dragons.
You're going to answer a question, and we'll see who comes closest, and we'll decide from there. So, to start off, each of you has to guess what the Rotten Tomatoes score of Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn's summer 2017 kidnapped by Ecuadorian gangsters comedy Snatched sits at on Rotten Tomatoes. What do you think, Katie, percent-wise? What does it sit at?
I'm going to say 32%.
Okay, 32. David, what do you think?
18.
Wow, dismal. 18. Dave, love for Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn? What?
24.
54?
24.
Oh, that's worse. Oh, Katie, you were the closest. It has 35%.
Woo!
Everyone liked it a little more than you all thought. Sad. I didn't see it. Did you? Did anyone? Did America?
No.
No.
I feel like I saw that preview
now.
500 times for some reason.
Yeah,
so whatever was in theater, like, whatever's in theaters like 2 months before it, I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, that's definitely an HBO destined for David's long ambient nights movie.
No, I don't think I could get through that one, but yeah.
All right, so we'll go Katie, Dave, David here. All right, category number one. Ready, Katie? It's very simple.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about summer's biggest moments. We're gonna talk about the summer's biggest movies. All you have to do is name the movie. So in this summer movie,
all right,
a secret society known as Prodigium solves ancient mysteries. What's the movie?
Oh, I'm going to guess The Mummy.
That is correct.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
The Prodigium, The Dark
Nor
Universe.
Will I ever.
Talk about something we're all waiting for more movies of. All right, Dave. In this summer movie, James Franco is seen sleeping, and then he dies, and he has no lines. What is that movie?
That would be Alien Covenant.
That is right. He's also in a photograph at some point. See, we're getting started. I don't usually go this easy in the beginning. I want to build up your confidence. David?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
Yeah.
In this movie, an 11-year-old boy motorboats a diner waitress before dying of a brain tumor. Do you know what movie this is?
Fuck. 11-year-old boy dies of brain tumor. I mean, I want to say The Book of Henry, but I didn't see The Book of Henry. Is that... That's not how he dies, or he gets murdered. It's not a brain tumor. Hold on. I'll get there.
Okay.
11-year-old boy, brain tumor.
You are Book of Henrying right now. You're working it out in your head.
11-year-old boy, motorboats a waitress.
Yeah.
And then dies of a brain tumor. I'm guessing it's a comedy.
Sure. Right? I'm pretty sure it's a motorboat. He gets pretty close. It's either a kiss or a motorboat.
Don't we have,
don't we have
a timer on these things?
Yeah, you're yeah, five,
if it's,
four.
If he doesn't motorboat the waitress, then that is a rigged
one.
Question.
What's your answer?
I gotta go with The Book of Henry.
You were right. Of course, it's The Book
yes!
of Henry.
Yes.
And what else could it have been?
You're thinking of the salmon girl. She gets murdered.
Must be the salmon girl, right?
All right, now it's time for box office fun. Katie, this summer saw the release of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man, Tell No Tales. And it became the lowest grossing movie of all five Pirates of the Caribbean movies in the U.S. But where did Dead Man, Tell No Tales rank worldwide out of five Pirates movies? What position is it in?
I'm going to say
first, second. Third, fourth, fifth. What did you say?
Second.
No, fourth.
Oh, is a bomb there? I thought it did better over. I mean, I guess it must have done better overseas.
It made $791 million. And it only made $172 million here. Will we still get a sequel? I don't know. How does that work anymore? Are we done with the Pirates movies?
I don't know.
I mean, isn't Orlando Bloom back or something? I didn't see this new one either.
Spinoff. The Pirates universe. All right, Dave. Despicable Me 3 became the second highest grossing Despicable movie domestic-wise. And I'm not counting Minions here. So it just it actually just snuck above the original Despicable Me movie by about $3 million. Where does Despicable Me 3 rank in the trilogy? First, second, or third? Top grossing, lowest grossing, middle grossing? No Minions.
Never Minions. Middle grossing.
No, it's actually the highest grossing Despicable Me movie. It's getting bigger.
Two?
The Phenomenon.
Jesus.
It made $972 million worldwide and $254 million here at home. Just for reference, Minions made $1.1 billion worldwide.
Why do they even bother with Despicable Me movies now?
They probably already had it in the works, right? Or if you you can have Minions 1 year and then Despicable Me other. So you get both.
It's the Star Wars. The Star Wars switch.
All right. David, Transformers The Last Knight. The kickoff to the Transformers cinematic universe featuring Cogman was the lowest grossing Transformers movie to date domestically. It was not good here. Mm. But of the five films, where do you think it ranks worldwide?
I think that it ranks... I think that it ranks second.
It actually ranks dead last.
Wow!
Whoa.
Even with the uptick in China's box,
it actually did not do well overseas either, which makes the future of Transformers particularly interesting. Now, it did make $603 million worldwide,
right?
Which is nothing to scoff at. But for a Transformers movie, you want it to do like $1 billion, so that was way underperforming. It should be noted that Michael Bay's worst movie of all time is The Island. I think everyone should know that. So,
worst performing.
Yeah, The Last Knight made $130 million here. The Island made $35 million. Embarrassing.
Oh, I saw The Island in theaters.
As did I. I think I saw it in like a sneak preview even.
Okay, here's a category that none of you will get, I bet. There was a great year. It was a great summer for musicians and movies. So, Katie, which major release of the year, of the summer, co-stars the rapper of the Grammy-winning, women's rights-focused single, Unity?
Oh, my God.
You're not a fan?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I feel like anything I guess is going to make me sound more out of touch than I actually am.
Unity was out in 1994, to give you some
holy
perspective.
Shit. Is it Girls Trip?
Yes, it is!
Yay!
Congratulations! Queen Latifah! Perfect.
Thank you. That 94 thing really helped.
Oh, man. Well, I guess I should give everyone the same little hit there. All right, Dave, which major release of the year co-stars the singer of Something New featuring Chris Brown? The hot single from 2016.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets?
Oh, no, it's Spider-Man Homecoming starring Zendaya.
Damn.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah,
Zendaya did a song with Chris Brown in 2016?
Yeah.
Man, wow.
Did you say Chris Pratt?
See, I assumed it was just... I assumed it was a Rihanna backlash that I just hadn't paid attention to, so that was... Wrong guess.
Sorry.
Wrong guess,
sorry.
Dave.
Okay, David.
Hey, David, I bet the answer to your question is Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I sure hope it is.
Let's see. David, which major release stars the composer and pianist of the 1964 jazz standard Cantaloupe Island? Not a Rihanna song. I'll say that.
What was
it's
that?
Not a Rihanna song.
Yeah. Cantaloupe Island, the composer and jazz pianist.
Yes. 1964. Co-starring in a major summer release.
A major summer release.
For sure. Big.
Big. What is my Katie hint?
Your Katie hint is 1964 jazz standard.
What?
Very few jazz musicians co-starred in blockbuster films this summer. I'll say that. I couldn't tell who was who in Dunkirk, so I can't say for sure if there wasn't a jazz. Does Mark Rylance play jazz?
He does.
He probably does.
I am going to...
Does Cogman play jazz?
Cogman does not play jazz. I'm definitely going to get this one wrong.
I'm going to tell you. I'll give you 5 seconds.
I am going to go with Baby Driver.
No. Dave, you should have listened to Dave. The movie is Valerian in the City of a Thousand Planets. The actor, Herbie Hancock.
Oh, of course.
Wow.
God damn.
All right. Next round.
Wow.
Wonder Woman. Big movie. Everyone loved it. Pretty important. Let's do an entire round about Wonder Woman. Katie, what is the name of the island that Wonder Woman grows up on?
Themyscira.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can be taught. The audience can be taught.
All right, Dave. How many volumes are there of Cleo's Criticism on Earthly Pleasures, the book series that taught Diana everything she knows about human reproduction?
Oh, God damn it.
That question seems way harder than mine.
Yeah.
Five? No, question. I'm sorry. There are 12 volumes of Cleo's Criticism.
Damn it.
Hey, some questions are going
to
be harder.
I feel like I'm about to be in the same boat as you.
All right, Dave.
Just answer for Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
Here we go. David, name any character in Wonder Woman who is not Diana, Steve Trevor, or Ares.
I was about to say Steve.
All you have to do is name any other character in the movie. There are many.
Wait, what was Dave's question again?
How many volumes were in the lovemaking manual?
Yeah, but who wrote it?
Cleo is not a character in the film.
Wait, was Ares one of the characters that you mentioned?
Yes.
Ares is one you cannot name.
It was Ares, Steve, and Diana.
Yes.
Yeah, you gotta name another one.
Anybody else in the movie. This is a big movie.
Her mom.
Her mom. She does have a mom, but her mom has a name. And we respect women, and we want to name them. So, because you paid attention, you're going to name.
Wait, hold on. What about like the doctor,
Yeah,
Doctor Death. What's his?
I would even take her like supervillain name, which is not her real name.
Like fucking.
Oh boy, I don't think you're doing this.
No, hold on. I'm trying to think. There was the Native American guy who was
over
there.
Yes, there's Danny Houston as the German officer.
Right, and then there was the woman from the Almodovar movie who was like...
Yeah, she plays the villain.
There's Robin Wright.
No, there's Robin Wright. That's the training lady. There's Connie Nielsen, her mother. Like, this is a big movie. This made $800 million.
Wasn't the mom's name like Clytemnestra?
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there before you say something you can't take back. You did not get this one. Other characters include Antipi, Robin Wright's character. I don't know how to
pronounce it. Clytemnestra was the wife of Agamemnon and queen of Mycenae.
Hippolyta, Connie Nielsen's mother character. Erich Ludendorff, the general. You were thinking of Dr. Poison.
Dr. Poison!
Dr. Poison!
Chief Napi.
Wait.
The Native American.
Wait, hold on.
So, you didn't get that one. Sorry, Wonder Woman. Maybe not as big a movie as we thought. Anyway, next category. You know, as many of us know, summer is award season. So, let's talk about the big award winners from the summer. So, Katie.
Oh, boy.
This summer, the hilarious comedian Adam Devine? Yeah, Devine. Hosted the MTV Movie and TV Awards. Got rebranded this year. So which, this is not a TV question. Which master thespian took home the coveted Best Actor Award at the MTV Movie Awards this year? Taraji P. Henson in Hidden Figures? Was it Daniel Kaluuya in Get Out? Was it Hugh Jackman in Logan? Was it James McAvoy in Split? Was it Haley Steinfeld in The Edge of 17? Or was it Emma Watson in Beauty and the Beast?
I do believe it was that groundbreaking hero, Emma Watson, who just broke all gender barriers by winning that prize.
Yes, correct.
Whole lot of back padding going on around that award.
Oh, my. All right, Dave, this past June, huge award ceremony. It was the 43rd annual Saturn Awards, honoring the best in science fiction, fantasy, and horror films that most of us already forgot because they're honoring things from a year ago, not this actual summer. So what took home the best horror movie award at the Saturns this year? Was it The Autopsy of Jane Doe, The Conjuring 2, Demon, Don't Breathe, Ouija Origin of Evil, Train to Busan, which I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, or The Witch?
I'm going to say The Witch.
No, it was Don't Breathe, that classic horror movie that everyone's talking about still.
Oh, man.
With the blind guy.
I like Fede Alvarez. That's Fede Alvarez, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, don't like it.
Oh, boy. It has, there's like a turkey base. I don't even want to go there.
Yeah, that's just mean-hearted director.
David, big awards moment that just happened this week. This week. Okay. Esteemed critic Lights Camera Jackson announced the winners of his coveted LCG Summer Movie Awards.
God damn it. God damn it.
Categories in the LCG Summer Movie Awards include Best Chemistry, Pleasant Surprise, and the Are You Kidding Me movie of the summer. But which movie took home LCJ's biggest disappointment? Was it Cars 3, Despicable Me 3, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, or War for the Planet of the Apes?
Oh my god. Cars 3, let me Book of Henry this out. So Cars 3 couldn't have been that big of a disappointment for him, because Cars 2, even Lights, Camera, Jackson had to recognize wasn't that good. Despicable Me 3, I understand that Lights, Camera, Jackson has yet to hit puberty, but is actually like 25
years
old. So I can't imagine that would have... So that leaves us with... War for the Planet of the Apes, and what was the
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
This is a real tough coin flip, but I think because Guardians of the Galaxy 2 came out at the start of the summer, and people were all revved up for summer action, and Lights, Camera, Jackson is a really easy lay. when it comes to Marvel things, I'm guessing. And War of the Planet of the Apes, which I did not see, but I imagine it's a bit heavier, a little bit out of his intellectual range. I'm going to go with War of the Planet of the Apes.
I'm sorry you did not Book of Henry yourself. It was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. No! You were so close.
Oh, no.
I really read that, man.
Book of Henry let you down.
I should also note that there is a category in the LCJ Summer Movie Awards called Not As Bad As Everyone Else Said, and the winner this year was The Emoji Movie. So I'm going to have to go back and watch the Emoji Movie now.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations, TJ Miller.
Okay, there's one more category, and I feel like anyone could still win, because we're going to play a quick round of the IMDb movie game. Now, Katie, you love this game. Am I correct?
Yeah.
I don't know. Invented by our friend Joe Reed. Are you familiar with how this works?
I believe so, but refresh our audience.
So basically, I'm going to give you the name of a famous actor, and you have to guess the four movies that appear first on the like IMDb mobile app. So basically, based on like popularity and search and the weird metrics that would put these movies in front of you on an IMDb page, those are the ones that display. It's not always, you know, they're big winning, like award-winning movies or the things that you think are most popular. You have to get in the minds of an IMDb user, your regular Joe searching on IMDb. So you're going to get, I'll give you two wrong answers as a chance to guess all four. Katie, you're first. And you know how to do this, so this should be easy.
So do I get hints?
No, I'm not going to give you any hints for time's sake. Okay. You get two misses, but I'm not giving you any hints. Here we go. Your person is The Rock, star of Baywatch this summer. What are the top four IMDb movies for Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
Let's start with Fast and Furious 7.
No.
Oh,
that's
shit.
That's an X.
All right. Fast 5?
Already done. Cut her off.
Oh, my God.
You're guessing Fast 5?
I love this guy.
You're guessing Fast 5?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Okay.
So that's two down.
I know. He's been in so many goddamn movies. How about Central Intelligence?
No!
Oh, no!
This could be a change of pace. Well, I should also say, yeah, well, I should have said one was animated. I'm going to give you another chance.
Oh.
Because I usually tell people if there's an animated movie on the list. There's one animated movie on the list. Do you know what it is?
Oh, God, I can't even think of what animated movie he's been in. Clearly, I have to hand in my Rock super fan credentials.
I know, you're always tweeting about The Rock and how...
Oh, it's Moana.
Yes, it is Moana. I'll give you that. You get 1 point.
Okay,
you get Moana,
thank God.
But everything else, you failed. So first off, Fast and Furious 6 is the FF entry that makes The Rock's top picks for some reason. And then you have San Andreas, that classic disaster movie. Starring The Rock.
Watch that in a hotel once.
And then you have G.I. Joe Retaliation, a movie I can't believe people are thinking about or searching about. Maybe people just don't search for The Rock on IMDb. They just know when he's going to be in a movie. Then again, no one saw Baywatch.
Yeah.
So, Katie, you get 1 point from this round. I think you've been in the lead, so this could be a huge turn.
I know, evening things up.
Okay, Dave, you get Scarlett Johansson, the star of this summer's Rough Night, a movie I don't think many people saw.
Okay. Lost in Translation.
Ding.
Avengers.
Yes.
Oh man.
Ghost in the Shell.
No.
Lucy.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Shit.
One more.
Oh, one more.
Yeah, you get one. It's
yeah,
one more.
You got.
Lost in Translation, The Avengers, Lucy, and this is probably going to be
none
the
of
tough
them
one.
Are none of them are animated.
None of them are animated.
Oh,
this is going to be the tough one.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona?
No.
Damn
so
it.
That's two X's. You get one more guess.
I get one more guess? Okay.
Talk it through.
See, now I just want to say The Island because we talked about it, but obviously it's not going to be The Island.
Don't waste your shot.
It's not going to be... I already said Lost in Translation. It's not going to be Under the Skin... it's probably not going to be that, but I'm going to say that to end the round. Is it We Bought a Zoo?
Good God, no.
It's got to be like one of the Avengers movies, right?
Well, I said the Avengers
he
already.
Said Avengers.
Yeah, but you could have said Avengers Age of Ultron. You could have said Captain America Civil War, Captain America.
Oh, I could have. You're
actually,
right.
All of those would have been wrong. Her fourth movie is The Prestige.
What?
Wow.
I don't know the field, but
Christopher
maybe the
Nolan fanboys
actor.
Run Nolan, IMDb. Yeah. Nolan.
This is the nuance of the IMDb game, right? Like Nolan, the kids love him on the IMDb forums, and that could play a role. Okay, David.
Yeah.
You have Idris Elba, star of The Dark Tower. What are Idris Elba's top four movies? One of them is animated.
Fuck. Well, that would be Zootopia.
Correct. I'm surprised you remember that.
Yeah, very memorable voice performance in the movie.
What does he play? Is he the giant ox?
I was gonna say Jungle Book.
Oh right, Jungle Book.
Well,
do you count Jungle Book as an animated movie?
The Jungle Book could also be an answer. Interesting.
If that was my hint for you, David, I guess I'll go with
the Jungle Book.
Wrong.
God damn it,
Katie.
I did not mean to lead you astray.
God damn it.
How many points behind is David for me? Do I want to help David or do I not want to help David?
I haven't calculated points.
I'll get there. Hang on.
Okay.
Idris Elba. Beast of No Nation did nothing for anyone.
Right. Clearly not, no.
And is it possible that the movie that came out this summer that inspired the question is one of the four?
It could be, technically, yes.
But it's not in this case.
I'm not going to say that.
Idris Elba. Oh, how about Prometheus?
Yes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. He's in Prometheus.
I was about to say. I feel like that's one of the more obscure ones.
Who
he sits in the spaceship the entire
out
time.
Fucking Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
And okay, so we got Zootopia. We got Prometheus. You're Idris Elba. You're in movies. What are you in?
What if there was some sort of cancelable apocalypse?
Ah, Pacific Rim.
Yeah, wow. What do you stand to benefit here, Dave?
I just wanted to know if I was right with my guess.
Right. Pacific Rim. And was he in any Christopher Nolan movies? No.
You still have two guesses here, like two flubs, right? You only guessed your big mistake was guessing Jungle Book on Katie's word,
right?
And she was trying
huge,
to
huge, huge mistake, huge.
Yeah.
So you might as well
sabotage.
Take
huge
a shot.
Mistake. Shit.
Was he in? No, he wasn't.
And I can say Luther is not on this list. I would tell
you. Yeah, I know Luther was obviously my first thing, but you said movies. Idris Elba. Always so memorable. Always.
Except
super,
for all of these other times.
He's totally there. And he's like, hey, I'm Idris. And
is that what he says all the time?
Yeah, yeah. And like, it's.
All right, you're running out of time here, man.
Wait, hold on. All right, I'm going to throw one out there. I know that this game is biased towards movies that have been out for a while, but just out of desperation, I'm going to throw out Dark Tower.
No.
Okay.
Go older than that.
And, yeah, the older the better.
Unless he's put out a movie.
I guess I will go with Beast of No Nation.
No. What is the movie? Thor.
Age of Ultron. Oh, damn it.
Oh, I forgot he was in Thor.
Oh, yeah.
So with a score of 5-4-4, Katie still wins, even though she...
Woo! Take that, The Rock! Disastrous IMDb game.
By eating on the podcast.
Oh man, that really is the best revenge.
Well, congrats. It was another memorable, great summer of fun.
Patches matches!
Yeah. Patches matches!
Time to watch Snatched.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. And I'm coming back to life from Game of Thrones. And I'm on Twitter, at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can leave comments and questions that we'll read, and everything's possible on fightinginthewarroom.com. And read Dave at Thrillist about Game of Thrones. When I say Game of Thrones, I'm talking about working with Dave, and he'll plug it too.
I'll plug it in a second. First David, though.
I'm David Rolick. I have not written anything about Game of Thrones. I watched the finale of Game of Thrones last night, and moments of it were
not the time. Not the time.
Not the time. Not the time. All right. Gotta focus. Gotta focus. fuck. Fighting in the War Room. Wait, no, I'm not there yet. Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at David Rolick. You can find me on IndieWire, where I will be out covering Telluride Film Festival this weekend, Liberty weekend, and then off to Toronto for the Toronto Film Festival. You can find all of us together on Facebook, Fighting in the War Room. It's where the love is.
Yeah, it's the answer to that Black Eyed Peas song from years ago.
yes.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me at Thrillist.com. I'm pretty sure you could go back in this episode and hear Patches realize I haven't sent him my final post yet. That's definitely happening. It'll be up. You're going to love it. It's about Game of Thrones. I also have a podcast, Storm with Spoilers, but you can find it at FightingInTheWarRoom.com since you're going there anyway.
Good job. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where we're still writing about Game of Thrones, all courtesy of Joanna, as usual. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, and you can find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about lots of things or just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of the end of Game of Thrones season, what is your favorite pop culture scene of undead destruction?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.